But BTS still has the number one album in the United States. But coming in at number two is Megan Thee Stallion. That was her with Beyonce Savage. I'm Nikki.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, John Russell, and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Two major dictionary publishers have chosen pandemic as the 2020 word of the year. Merriam-Webster and Dictionary.com both declared their choices on Monday. Merriam-Webster said its decision was based on the extremely high numbers of people who had looked up pandemic in its online dictionary in 2020. The word showed a major year-over-year increase in internet traffic, the company said. The World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic on March 11th. The Merriam-Webster Learner's Dictionary defines pandemic as an occurrence in which a disease spreads very quickly and affects a large number of people over a wide area or throughout the world. Searches for pandemic on the Merriam-Webster website rose more than 115,000% on March 11th compared to a year earlier. The dictionary's choice of pandemic should not come as a shock to anyone, said Peter Sokolowski, editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster. Sokolowski told the Associated Press that major news events often have a technical word related to them. In the case of the coronavirus crisis, the word pandemic is not just technical but has become general. He added that pandemic is also a word that will likely be used in the future to describe this period in history. Sokolowski noted that pandemic has roots in Latin and Greek. It is a combination of pan, meaning for all, and demos, for people or population. Pandemic dates to the mid-1600s, when it was used widely for universal. Around that time, it also began appearing in medical literature after the plagues of the Middle Ages, he said. Sokolowski said the huge increase in interest did not appear to be only among searchers who did not know the meaning of the word. Many people were also hunting for more details about pandemic or were seeking for inspiration or to help ease their minds, he added. Merriam-Webster said it acted quickly to add new information on words related to pandemic. The dictionary already had coronavirus for many years, but it added COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, about a month after that term was officially created in February. In announcing its choice, Dictionary.com said searches for pandemic on its website increased more than 13,000% on March 11th. Dictionary.com research editor John Kelly told the AP that searches for the word have remained high throughout the year. For about half of the year, the company said pandemic was in the top 10% of all search requests. As we recently reported, other dictionaries also chose COVID-19-related terms as their 2020 Word of the Year. Britain's Cambridge Dictionary chose quarantine. It said searches for the word increased in March when many countries ordered public restrictions to limit the spread of COVID-19. Cambridge said quarantine had taken on new meaning, so it added to its definition. It now says quarantine is a general period of time in which people are not allowed to leave their homes or travel freely so that they do not catch or spread a disease. Collins Dictionary, another British publisher, chose lockdown. It said the word represents a uniting experience for people across the world. Under lockdown in 2020, Collins said normal public life is suspended, and we see few people and fewer places. I'm Brian Lynn.
Some Bitcoin investors predict the virtual currency could rise to as high as $100,000 in a year. That is around 5 times its current value. The predictions have drawn criticism from those who believe Bitcoin is a speculative asset, something a person or company owns that involves too much financial risk. Since January, Bitcoin has increased by 160%. It is getting close to its all-time height of just under $20,000 in December 2017. It was last trading at $18,415. Brian Estes is Chief Investment Officer at Off the Chain Capital. It is a hedge fund, a group of investors who take financial risks together in order to try to earn a lot of money. Going from $18,000 to $100,000 in 1 year is not impossible, Estes noted. I have seen Bitcoin go up 10 times, 20 times, 30 times in a year. So going up 5 times is not a big deal. Estes predicts Bitcoin could hit between $100,000 and $288,000 by the end of 2021. Tom Fitzpatrick, an expert at international banking group Citi, said in a note last week that Bitcoin could climb as high as $318,000 by the end of next year. Fitzpatrick said the rise could come because of the currency's limited supply, ease of movement across borders, and unclear ownership. However, those numbers do not make sense to Toronto-based Kevin Muir, an independent trader. He says he does not expect such huge gains for Bitcoin. Is it plausible? Muir said. For sure, it's a mania. Mania is an extreme excitement or desire for something that is usually shared by many people. But Muir added that no one really has a clear idea about how high Bitcoin will go. Bitcoin relies on so-called mining computers that approve or confirm groups of transactions. The computers compete to solve mathematical puzzles every 10 minutes. The first to solve the puzzle and clear the transaction is awarded new bitcoins. Bitcoin's technology was designed to cut the reward for miners in half every 4 years. The idea behind the move was to reduce inflation. In May, Bitcoin went through a third halving, which reduced the rate at which new coins are created. This, in turn, reduced supply. That halving started Bitcoin's renewed growth. I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. The American drug maker Moderna said Monday it has requested emergency use permission from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for its COVID-19 vaccine. It has also asked for conditional approval from the European Medicines Agency. Moderna's request comes just 10 days after Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech sought emergency use approval for its vaccine in the United States and across Europe. In addition, Britain is looking at data from the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine trial for a possible emergency approval. Early data from the Moderna and Pfizer studies show that both vaccine candidates are nearly 95% effective against COVID-19. Britain's Oxford-AstraZeneca group says its vaccine candidate is between 62 to 90% effective, depending on how the vaccine is given. The FDA requires that a vaccine be at least 50% effective in order to be considered for emergency use. None of the three groups has published complete data from their large Phase 3 studies in scientific papers. On November 23rd, the Oxford-AstraZeneca group said its vaccine treatment of a half first dose followed by a full second dose 1 month later, was found to be 90% effective. The treatment involving a full dose both times was found to be 62% effective. Scientists, however, remain concerned about the small number of volunteers who received the half first dose. AstraZeneca told the Reuters news agency that the smaller half-dose treatment was at first given to volunteers by mistake, but it said that there should be no concern, and it added that independent scientists and regulators have studied and approved the half-dose treatment. AstraZeneca chief Pascal Soriot said last week that the drug maker was likely to run more trials to study the effectiveness of its vaccine treatment using the half-first dose. A group of independent scientists known as the Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee will now study results from Moderna's and Pfizer's Phase 3 trials. The group will advise the FDA on the safety and effectiveness of the vaccine candidates. On December 10th, the FDA will meet to consider Pfizer's emergency use request. The agency plans to look at Moderna's request 1 week later. If the FDA approves its request, Moderna expects to have 20 million treatments by the end of 2020. Since the treatment requires 2 shots, that will be enough for 10 million people. Pfizer says it can supply 50 million vaccine treatments by the end of 2020, enough for 25 million people. It hopes to produce up to 1.3 billion treatments by the end of 2021. Based on agreements with the U.S. government, vaccines from Moderna and Pfizer will cost between $15 and $25 a treatment. Oxford AstraZeneca's vaccine will cost under $4. Unlike vaccine candidates from Pfizer and Moderna, the vaccine from the Oxford AstraZeneca group does not require extreme cold storage. This, along with its lower cost, makes the vaccine a good candidate for many countries around the world. The drug maker added it will also seek an emergency use listing from the World Health Organization to make the vaccine available sooner. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the spring of 1865, the American Civil War was over, and the president who had led the Union during that war was dead. Abraham Lincoln had been murdered before the final surrender of Confederate forces. Now, the reunited nation had a new president, Andrew Johnson. He had been Lincoln's vice president. The Chief Justice of the United States swore Johnson into office a few hours after Lincoln's death. Most of Lincoln's cabinet was there, together with leading members of Congress. They looked to the new president with a mixture of shock and hope. Shep O'Neill and Tony Riggs begin the story of America's 17th president.
Andrew Johnson was, like Abraham Lincoln, a man of the people. He was born in North Carolina. His family was poor. There was no money or time for young Andrew to go to school. When he was 14 years old, his mother sent him to work for a tailor to learn to make clothes. Andrew worked hard. He opened his own tailoring business in the eastern part of the state of Tennessee. When he was 18, he married. His wife, Eliza, taught him to read and write.
Andrew became active in politics. At the age of 21, he was elected to the town council. 2 years later, he became mayor of the town. At 35, he won a seat in Congress in Washington. Next, he became governor of Tennessee. Then the state made him one of its two senators. The poor tailor boy was a success.
Andrew Johnson was a member of the Democratic Party. In the presidential election of 1860, he supported his party's candidate, not the candidate of the Republican Party, Abraham Lincoln. But Lincoln won the election, and, as a result, southern states carried out their earlier threat. They began leaving the Union to form their own nation. Johnson opposed this secession. He believed the South should remain part of the United States. He decided he had no choice but to support the Republican president. Most of the other citizens in Tennessee disagreed with him. They decided to leave the Union. Andrew Johnson had to flee his home to save his life. He returned only after Union forces took control of Tennessee and made him military governor.
President Lincoln noticed the man from Tennessee who supported the Union over the opposition of others. In 1864, Lincoln decided to run for re-election. He chose Johnson to be his vice presidential candidate. Lincoln hoped Johnson would win the support of Union-loving Democrats. He hoped Johnson would help heal the wounds between North and South. Now, Lincoln was dead, and Johnson was president. It was up to this little-known former tailor to make the decisions on Reconstruction, on rebuilding the Union. Johnson, not Lincoln, would decide if Reconstruction would be easy or hard. Johnson would choose if the North would punish the defeated rebel states or be merciful to them.
The radicals of Lincoln's Republican Party wanted severe Reconstruction. They said the South was a defeated enemy. They demanded strong punishment for all Southerners who took part in the rebellion. These radicals had disliked Lincoln's plans for Reconstruction. They felt he was too weak. Now, they hoped Johnson would share their ideas. They urged him to call a special session of Congress to pass strong legislation against the South. The radicals had reason to believe the new president agreed with them. He had called the rebels traitors. He had demanded strong action against them when the war ended. "The time has come," Johnson had said, "when the American people should understand what crime is, and that it should be punished."
But Andrew Johnson surprised the radicals. He did not call the special session of Congress. Instead, he announced his own program for the Southern states. Johnson declared a pardon for all former Confederates who promised to support the Union and obey laws against slavery. Then he permitted former officials of the Confederacy to run for office in their state's new elections. Many of these former rebels were elected. The radical Republicans were angry. They saw these elections as proof that the South had not really changed. They accused Johnson of being too soft. They urged him to punish the rebels. One radical newspaper wrote, "There is only one sure and safe policy for the immediate future. The North must remain the dictator of the Republic until the spirit of the North shall become the spirit of the whole country. The South's treason is still unpunished. Southerners cannot be trusted."
The radicals also worried about what would happen to the recently freed slaves. They said the new state governments of the South would not treat blacks as free and equal citizens. As proof, they pointed to new laws the Southern legislatures passed. For example, the state legislature in Mississippi said no black person could rent farmland. It said a black person needed special permission to work at any job except farming.
Mississippi also passed a law saying a black person could be forced to work for a white man, usually his former owner, if he had no other job. Another way the state governments in the South acted against blacks was by refusing to give them the right to vote.
The radical Republicans decided that President Johnson's Reconstruction program must be stopped. They began working to get control of Congress, to pass their own program. Only by gaining political power could they punish the South and guarantee full political rights to former slaves. The radicals tried to take control in two ways. First, they refused to let many of the recently elected Southern congressmen take their seats when Congress opened. Then they formed their own Joint Committee on Reconstruction. This committee, not the Senate or the House of Representatives, would make many of the decisions about Reconstruction.
Radical lawmakers took other steps to seize control of Reconstruction efforts in the South. Congress had established a government agency to take care of black refugees in the South. The agency gave food and clothing to former slaves who had no food, money, or jobs. It began to teach them to read and write. Republicans in Congress moved to extend the life of the agency and increase its powers. They passed a bill and sent it to the White House for the president's approval. President Johnson vetoed the bill. He said it would create false hopes among former slaves. He also said it was unconstitutional. The radicals tried to overturn Johnson's veto. However, they failed to get the necessary votes.
Congress passed several other bills giving the federal government power to protect the rights of blacks in the southern states. President Johnson vetoed these bills, too. He said they interfered with the rights of the states. These defeats made the radicals even more angry. Their newspapers began a steady attack against the president and his policy toward the South. Some even accused him of treason.
Many Americans agreed with this criticism of President Johnson. They gave the radicals a big victory in congressional elections of 1866. Radical leaders gained the power to pass any bill they wished, even over the president's veto. And they wasted no time doing just that. Time after time, they voted to overturn Andrew Johnson's vetoes. The atmosphere in Washington became very tense. Relations between Congress and the White House sank to their lowest level in history. The political skies darkened. Soon, the storm broke. The radicals tried something that had never been tried before. They tried to remove the president from office. The conflict between the radicals and Andrew Johnson would provide some of the most historic and intense moments in American history. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.